Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Bodice Blatherings, our podcast where we natter about Bodice history, the curious, the shadowy and often magical history of this part of the world in which we live. Mary, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm a little bit down. As I mentioned before we started recording, Cassie is going for another operation on Friday. So I'm a little bit nervous about that. Right. But otherwise, okay. Mm-hmm. I had a thought for today. And today I'm really going to have to rely heavily on your extensive historical knowledge.
Go Jings.
Because I'm coming at this, if you bear with me while I do a rather roundabout introduction. Remember we were talking when I came to see you in the archive recently, we were talking about holiday plans and where we'd been and our travels and so on. That made me think about something which happened to me while I was working in Turkey. Mm-hmm. I walked into what passed for my classroom one day. Mm-hmm. This was in Central Anatolia. To be met by a group of 8 or 9 rather agitated students.
Right.
My first thought was, what the hell have I done wrong? And what transpired was they had a clipping from the English language newspaper in Turkey, the Turkish Daily News. And there was an article concerning a poem by Maya Angelou. Famous for I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And Hulusi, one of the students in particular, ran forward slapping this paper and saying, this is stolen from Anatolian Turkish poet.
Right.
It's stolen. You know? So I taught them plagiarism and felt I was standing there defending the values of the West.
Right. Okay.
They were very agitated.
Oh, okay.
And I tried in a rather negotiating kind of way to say, well, maybe that's a talent to be able to. Picasso said something like that, you know, knowing how to borrow or to steal from other people.
Yeah,
that didn't
yeah.
help. That made me soft. And so that made me think about this whole issue of origin and ownership. And the story that, and bear in mind at that time, many Turkish people, and I lived through this, were so anti-West because of movies like Midnight Express and how the Turkish people had been portrayed in that movie, and they felt the Greek was trying to encircle them politically and so on. So this was the final nail in the coffin for my students. Uh-huh. The fact that some well-known American poet and writer had stolen from an original Turkish manuscript. So I felt the story that we could talk about today, which I think has everything and which deals with the issue of ownership and origin, is good old King Arthur and the Arthurian legend.
Ah, Arthur.
How do you feel about that?
And Table and Merlin and all these sorts of people.
Because origin and ownership, who knows?
Scottish borders, we're sitting not very far from Arthur's seat.
Yes.
So we know King Arthur was there. And we know that we have two rivers in the borders, one called the Whitaker and one the Blackaker. Mm-hmm. And they were created by Merlin.
Yeah.
And of course, we know from the Ygdodin poem that Scottish borders was part of the Henoglyph, the Old North of the Welsh.
And we did a podcast on
And Ygdodin is one of the earliest mentions of Arthur, and Merlin's in there as well. So are we Welsh? Are we Scottish? Were Arthur and Merlin Scottish? Were they Welsh? Am I going to get brickbats the next time I go to Wales? Yeah. People saying that I've pinched Arthur and Merlin from them? Yes, that's going to be interesting.
Well, with my current lack of knowledge, my money's on Welsh. But
well, let's see where we go.
Let's talk about origin and ownership.
Absolutely.
I think the Arthurian legend has everything in a sense, which is why its footprint is everywhere.
Oh, it's an enduring legend, absolutely.
You've got courtly love, you have infidelity, you have chivalry, dashing knights on quests for mythical creatures and relics. References everywhere to King Arthur, the Round Table, and Merlin. And on my travels, interestingly, in Cornwall, up the road in Edinburgh, as you say, and believe it or not, once at the summit of Mount Etna in Sicily, I heard the discussion of Mount Etna being the final resting place of King Arthur.
Wow, okay, that's a new one on me.
So, this story, which has developed incredibly, when I lived in the States, the John F. Kennedy presidency was often referred to as the Camelot administration.
Of course, yes, yes, that's right.
And when I lived in Germany, I often visited Wewelsburg Castle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the rather darker side of the interpretation of the Arthurian legend, but Wewelsburg was acquired by Himmler and was to be the headquarters of the SS.
Yes.
And within Wewelsburg, you will see there is a Grail room,
mm-hmm.
there is a King Arthur room.
Yeah.
And in one room, you see almost a replication of the round table.
The infamous round table.
Now, it's concreted now.
Yeah.
There's 12 pillars of concrete with a symbol which I believe to be a rose or a flower in the middle.
Right, yeah.
In the center of the circle. And rather ironically, in my opinion, Himmler had a gas pipe installed through to this center circle where they could burn an eternal flame. This was to be the symbol of the Thousand-Year Reich.
Yes. Yeah.
Because you know how the Arthurian legend caught on. They were questing for the Grail, mythical creatures, you name it.
Yeah, yeah.
They believed in that. I think I'll stop at that. I don't want to go down the political route. But
no, but it just shows you the influence that legend has, you know, a legend that has, to be fair, its actual origins we know are in Wales. And it has spread across Northern Europe, especially Germanic countries and Scandinavian countries.
Origins, yes. But what about ownership? Because many would claim to own the story. This is where I get confused.
Well, I mean, we know that the Ygod Odin is the first mention of Arthur and Merlin are in there. But we can sort of, who could we name blame? Geoffrey of Monmouth, that's who we can. Geoffrey of Monmouth, who was writing around about the 12th century. Now, here we go for dates, and everybody knows I don't do dates. 1066, the Norman invasion of England.
Yeah.
The Normans came across. They were, of course, originally Vikings, but anyway, they settled in North France, so they became Norman, and then they invaded England. Went charging across England and went into Wales. Now, there's a thing in the army, the sort of thing where if you're a conquering army, you're an invading army, you have to beat people militarily. But then, if you're going to settle in an area, you have to do the hearts and minds of the people.
Yeah.
You can't be constantly at a state of war. It's exhausting. And people will resist a constant state of war. So what you have to do is you have to say, no, we've got the right to be here. So what you do is you find yourself a nice little cleric, like Geoffrey of Monmouth, and you say, prove we have got the right to be here. And what Geoffrey of Monmouth did was he went scurrying back to all of the Welsh poems and the Welsh legends he could find to discover myths about Arthur and his advisor. Merlin was an advisor at that point. And so you have people like Uther Pendragon trying to build a castle, and the castle keeps falling down.
Sorry to interrupt, but this is King Arthur's dad, is that right?
Yes, possibly.
Possibly,
yeah. I think it is. There's a lot of maybes and mights and whats. So, Pendragon is, Uther is trying to build a castle and it keeps falling down. And Merlin comes along and says, well, you can't because there are two dragons fighting underneath it, a red dragon and a white dragon. And the red dragon is Wales, or the Britons, because everybody in Britain is Welsh at this point. Remember? And then the white dragon are the Normans, or maybe the Saxons. It's a little bit confused. It depends on which sources you read.
Yeah.
And the red dragon wins and wins and wins, and then eventually the white dragon wins. And so this is saying that if you build your castle, you have to accept that they have this right to be here. They have the right to be in charge of the country. And this is sort of what Merlin says. And then Arthur comes along as Uther's son. And to bring the people together, to bring the nobility together, he has his Knights of the Round Table. And then to cement things absolutely firmly, we're going to be very, very Christian and we're going to search for the Holy Grail. But of course, the origins of this sort of predate Christianity. You know, Arthur and Merlin were kicking about before we converted to Christianity.
Now, you're talking about the Holy Grail that is at Rosslyn Chapel, presumably.
Ah, well, now, remember that Joseph of Arimathea brought the Holy Grail, allegedly, to somewhere in southern England, or possibly Wales, and may or may not have buried it there. But Joseph of Arimathea wandered all over the place, so there are several places in Britain today that claim to have the Holy Grail. And God speaks in a vision and tells them to go and find his Holy Grail. And that allows the knights to charge about and then have their various adventures. Now, that's the sort of story level of it. But if you look at it at the political level, what Arthur was doing was he was saying, I've got God-given right to be here. I've got the God-given right to be in charge.
Yeah.
My knights and I are on a Christian mission. And as these knights go out into the countryside, they are telling people that Arthur exists. For those who have ever seen the Monty Python film, and Monty Python for the Hunt for the Holy Grail and Monty Python, there is a wonderful scene where one of the knights, King Arthur himself, speaks to some peasants and he says, "I'm your king, I'm King Arthur." And they say, "Well, we didn't vote for you," sort of type thing. And it's a lovely little scene, and it's quite funny about left-wing politics and all sorts of things, because, you know, we've got a collective when we have twice weekly meetings and we didn't vote for a king and why are you our king? But what Arthur was doing was when he was sending his knights out, because how else would he tell people?
Yeah.
The king is now King Arthur. He is the king, because Britain at that time was so many small different kingdoms. So that's why that grew out. And then, of course, as the poetry develops and the poems develop and the legends develop, then you bring in chivalric love and you bring in searching, and searching for something becomes a trope. If you think of almost all of the Hollywood movies,
I'm thinking Hollywood here. It's been a
you're on the search,
golden goose
for a something. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, they're after the Ark of the Covenant. You know, you're searching for something. And you can tell I don't go to the cinema very often. My film references are always about 30 years out of date.
The Sword in the Stone, isn't
it? The Sword in the Stone. Yeah. You know, but that's it. You're searching for something, and that becomes a noble quest.
Yeah.
Being on a noble quest is a good thing to do. Even if you die in the attempt, it's better to die in the attempt of a noble quest than it is just to sit home with your feet up and a cup of coffee.
Yeah. What you've just said, at risk of going off on a tangent, as I often do, there's lessons here for foreign policy. This idea, the one thing I would often say in defense of the ancient Islamic world is when they moved into a territory, they didn't, as the Americans and Brits often did, was set up divisions, close everything down, and impose. They would try and keep alive the basic traditions and way of life of those they had invaded. And
well, you can see that, though, because if you go in, if you invade a country and you impose your way of life, you impose your culture, you impose your political system, what happens is some people will knuckle down, a third of the population will knuckle down, a third of the population will absolutely resent you for forever, and a good third of the population will resist because they don't want to live by your rules.
Exactly.
And so you have to keep the country almost in a state of martial law. Whereas if you go into a country and say, right, we're taking over the politics, but your tax is just going to be the same, and we're not going to force you to read a different newspaper, we're not going to do anything about that, we're going to leave your culture alone. People say, oh, well, I'm paying my taxes, but, you know, there's still law and order, so, okay, I'm quite happy with that. Mm-hmm. And that's what Arthur was doing when he was sending his knights out. He was saying just to spread the word, I am Arthur. Mm-hmm. And it's also a show of the fact that everything's settled now. There's no more fighting going on. Look, we're here. You know, in various different stories, there are different numbers of the knights going out. And you have Merlin, who is he is magical, but he's more of an advisor at this stage when he starts off the Merlin myth. He's an advisor. And again, that's showing this is stable. I am a king.
Yeah.
I can defend you, but I have an advisor with me to allow us to live peacefully. So that's where the legends come from.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
So Merlin doesn't start life as a magic man.
He's not really. He's more of an advisor. He's somebody who has prophecies. He sort of has second sight. He's mentioned in some early poems. There's the name of a chap called Merlin. There's a Merthin. There's a Merdith. There's a chap called Ambrosius. And these all sort of come together to become the sort of Merlin that that we know of today. But he was more an advisor who, yes, had second sight and had prophecy. But he wasn't, you know, he wasn't waving a magic wand, doing things like that. He was prophesizing into the future and saying this could happen or that could happen or this is an auspicious day to go to battle. But everybody had advisors like that. That's what kings had. Although it's quite noticeable in Northern European mythology, leaders, kings, knights, emperors tend to be from the southern regions of countries, and advisors and magic men and magicians and wizards tend to be from the north. Because they have different powers from you and I. So they have to go into the wilderness to get these powers to commune with whatever powers are giving them prophecy. And if you think of Europe, it's north of Britain that's wild. It's the north of Finland. It's the north of Germany. So that's where your advisors tend to be from the north.
But at the risk of, you can see my lack of knowledge here and why I'm depending on you here, at the risk of not contradicting that, but have I not come across the historical theory that Merlin was a kind of poor cave dweller who lived in this part of the world, in the south, where we are
now,
roaming the Borders forests?
Yes, under the name Lilochan, he lived in the Borders, but the Borders, remember, from the poem Y Gododdin, is Hen Ogleth. It's the old
North. It's Welsh speaking, yeah.
It's the Welsh Old North.
Yeah.
Because we have Traprain Law, which is the religious centre, and Dunedin, which is Edinburgh. So although it's the southern part of Scotland, it's north if you're Welsh. If you're the Welsh King Arthur and you have your Welsh advisor Merlin, where is he originally going to come from? He's going to come from the north, the Hen Ogleth.
Yeah.
Which is why we know him as Lynocan up here and why we have actually got earlier sources, because we've got sources from the 5th century, because Geoffrey Monmouth's writing around about the 12th century. We have sources alongside St Kentigern from Glasgow in the 5th century, talking about the wild man of the woods, Lynokin. And that's where Merlin is. So if you come back to Geoffrey of Monmouth, Geoffrey of Monmouth talks about the death of Arthur and Mort d'Arthur and Malory and Sir Walter Scott were in the borders for that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
One of the points is that Merlin loses his mind when Arthur dies in the battle. And what he does is he goes up into the wild woods and becomes a wild man,
eating berries
and howling at the moon, and his wife and his sister have to come and try and drag him back, and they drag him back in chains, and that doesn't work, and he runs away, and they drag him back all the time. So yes, the wild man of the woods is known as Lynokin up here, but we'll keep to the name Merlin because I don't want to confuse you with more names.
Let's stick with Merlin.
All of that comes from Lord Arthur, the death of Arthur.
Yeah.
Which we've got with Malory and Sir Walter Scott's work on the Arthurian legend, because the Arthurian legend, we tend to think of, you know, him pulling the sword out of the stone, which proves he's a rightful king, and we've got the Knights of the Round Table. Very few people actually look at the death of Arthur and what happened and what would have happened. Because Arthur, I don't know if there was a one Arthur, but let's say there was, he may be an amalgam of several kings.
Yeah.
If he is the king that is controlling everything and he's holding power and he's keeping the peace, what does happen when he dies? What chaos is going on? You know, you've got all sorts of things going off with Lancelot and Guinevere and Gawain and all sorts of things. So it's like any power structure. If you have one head at the top of the power structure and they fall, there's then a scramble for power.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a free-for-all.
Yeah.
And it becomes really quite a frightening period for people.
Yeah.
And if Merlin, who was your advisor and who was able to prophesy things and keep everything on the straight narrow, if he then loses his mind and ends up wandering about the woods with a long beard and howling at the moon, that's terrifying for people. So it's the part of the myth that most people ignore because you don't want that part of the myth.
The looking at an English translation of Aegir Dudden. If I remember correctly, when we did that as a podcast topic, I came across a phrase in the English translation, which in reference to some very brave, heroic person.
Yeah.
The English translation said, but he was not Arthur. Now, if I take that literally, that suggests to me that Arthur was the pinnacle.
Yes.
In a sense. And may have existed. They were referring to someone. In a sense. Is that possible?
Well, if you think of the Aegir Dudden, what it's talking about is it's talking about them, you know, going up to Edinburgh, feasting for a year, and then coming down for this battle, which they lose. And they lose because he was not Arthur.
Yeah.
The Aegir Dudden is saying, you know, we don't have an Arthur anymore.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he fought bravely and he was great, but he was not an Arthur. There's also mention of Merlin in that poem, and it, again, it's quite ambiguous, but it's almost as if they're saying, and we didn't have a Merlin either.
Right.
We didn't have an Arthur to fight the battles, and we didn't have a Merlin to advise. Because again, they went up to Edinburgh for a year, they sat around drinking mead, as we know, and decided that they would attack the Romans at a Roman camp. And they lost the battle.
Yeah.
Would they have lost the battle if they had had Arthur, who was brave and a great strategist, and if they had had Merlin advising?
That's in a way what I read into that, yeah.
Talking
of the Romans, as you do, is it in any way possible? When I lived in Germany, the legend of King Arthur was, and I mentioned it a little bit in terms of Wewelsburg Castle, but the people I worked with were very aware, and it wasn't just Hollywood, you know, the sword in the stone and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They were very aware of the legend. Could it be possible that the genesis of the story comes from a Schwaben or Germanic warrior who took on the Romans?
It could well be. I mean, I think with the Arthurian legends, if you think about it, so the basic Welsh version of the legend is they were invaded by Saxons, Normans.
Yeah.
They had a king who defended them.
Yeah.
That was Arthur. If you look at Germany or the German states at that point, there were people coming in from the east,
yeah.
constantly invading.
Yeah.
They would have had a king who would have defended them.
Yeah.
Almost all of Europe's a strange bit of the world. We have been moving and migrating back and forth across Europe for millennia, you see?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if you are constantly being invaded, you're going to have a myth of a person who defended you and only was finally defeated by superior forces that should have been there. So that makes it okay. That makes invasion okay. But you still are proud of the original king. And that's why I think in Northern Europe, the Arthur legend remains. It doesn't remain as much in Southern Europe because the invasions in Southern Europe was more Moorish people coming up.
Yeah.
So it was a different set of things.
Yeah.
Whereas the Saxons, the Normans, the Britons, the Welsh, the Germans, the Russians, we were all sort of invading each other and we were all much of a muchness.
Yeah.
We weren't different. It wasn't a different culture coming in. It was just, you know, the guy from the next beer tent over had decided to come in sort of type thing.
Mm.
And so you can have your legend, and that's why it resonates in Germany. It's why it resonates in the Scandinavian countries and in the Netherlands, because you can see that, and because these countries are still in a state of having peoples coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can see that, and it can be something to cling on to, something to be proud of, and also something so that you can say, if we still had an Arthur, it would be all right. If we still had a Merlin, it would be okay. So the reason things are wrong now is not because you're not doing your best. It's not because the people who are invading are particularly strong. It's because you don't have an Arthur.
Mm.
If you had an Arthur, it would be all right. And that's quite comforting in a way. Although, you know, you're not getting what you want, but there's a reason why. Instead of just saying we're not getting what we want, I don't understand what's going on, but we don't have an Arthur.
Yeah.
He wasn't an Arthur. He couldn't make it.
I hope there's no one listening today who is thinking, well, we have Rishi Sunak now, but it's no Boris Johnson.
Well, I will be very kind to you, and I will use a football analogy.
Thank you.
Which I'm going to get wrong, folks, but
Ferguson.
I can still remember so many football fans.
Yeah.
Whenever Scotland loses a game, it's because we didn't have insert name of player or insert name of manager.
Uh-huh.
It's not that the team weren't good enough. It's that you didn't have a Jock Stein. For anybody who doesn't know, he was a big man in Scottish football.
Yes.
And that's it. Whenever Scotland lost, it was never the player's fault.
Yeah.
It was, we didn't have a Jock Stein.
Uh-huh.
And that's what you do. And that's comforting. So it allows to soften the blow of losing.
That is a brilliant analogy.
Hey.
Football and politics. Great. Because when Sir Alex Ferguson leaves Manchester United, they recruit another Scot, a fellow Scot, David Moyes.
Okay.
And he becomes the chosen one.
Ah.
So you see that little game being played.
He
didn't last long, unfortunately.
Yep. Uh-huh.
But the chosen one.
But it allows you to soften the blow.
If we had
an Arthur, if we had a Merlin.
Yep.
And
yep.
you can run that in any scenario you want.
Mm.
And so because you're always saying that to soften the blow of losing football, whatever, it keeps the legend going. You know, you have legends, we know of legends in Germany and Central Europe where, you know, the king is still asleep under the mountain. And one day he will waken up and come back
and
make everything better again. That's Arthur.
You know, Mary, the Scandinavian countries better than I. Is the Arthurian legend and the and Merlin himself, is that strong? Powerful?
Yes, it's strong in Scandinavian countries. Merlin more so than Arthur.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
But yes, again, a strong leader that has an advisor. And of course, as the legend has grown, and it's very interesting if you look at very recent terms, Merlin has changed from being an advisor to being much more magical. If you look at the court of Elizabeth I, she had an advisor called John Dee, who was an astronomer and an astrologer and an alchemist and a philosopher. And that was perfectly normal then.
Yeah.
He did magic. He was a magician.
Yeah.
And he pulled very heavily on the Merlin legends, the Arthurian and the Merlin legends.
Mm.
If you have things like the court of Louis XIV, where you had the affair of the poisons, and you had people in there who were magicians, and they were pulling on that, because witches were bad, but magicians are coming from an older tradition of philosophy, an older tradition of ancient knowledge, wisdom, occult knowledge.
Alchemy was very much part of that deal.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, today alchemy has obviously morphed into chemistry, you know, but you still get it with astrology. And it becomes much stronger. And of course, because in the Scandinavian countries, you have physical things such as Aurora Borealis, you have the Northern Lights, where you have this amazing light show that I'm sure the scientists can tell us it's all about solar flares hitting the Earth's atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you believe in magic and you believe you are a Merlin-type character, you can go up and interpret those signs.
And this role of advisor and counsellor and good, you know, steward, in a sense, if you think of Tolkien, used that with Gandalf.
Yes, very much, Gandalf. The and then if you look at J.K. Rowling, you've got Dumbledore.
Yeah.
And then I believe Harry Potter at the sort of end of the books. I haven't read the final books. He takes on that role himself.
Yeah.
So it's this role of advising through magic. You're not doing magic tricks, but you're advising through magic. We have Michael Scott in The Borders. All of these magicians are all drawing on that Merlin legend. And of course, the thing is that you can't really separate Merlin and Arthur. You can't just have Merlin on his own because he has to be advising someone.
Someone, yeah.
And you can't have Arthur on his own because he needs an advisor. Mm-hmm. So this is why when Arthur dies in that final battle, Merlin loses his mind because it should not have happened. Arthur should not have died in battle.
Mm.
You know, there are some versions of the legends as you go north where Arthur doesn't die. He loses the battle, but he does not die. He rides off.
Yeah.
And that's where you get, you know, the King Under the Mountain legends, and there are numerous of those.
No, Mount Etna, I do remember, yeah.
And
yeah.
one day he will waken and he will come back. I mean, that's a really strong legend in, for example, the Czech Republic.
Mm-hmm.
The King Under the Mountain will come back.
Yeah.
And I know in southern Germany you have the same thing. The King Under the Mountain will come. He didn't die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in modern times you have some modern Germanic kings that didn't quite die. It's not quite believed that he died. He did not drown in that lake. You know, so all of these things you can't have Arthur and Merlin sort of on their own, really.
Yeah, yeah.
The only time they're separate is when Merlin goes up to mourn. And what's interesting is that his wife and his sister spend their whole time trying to drag him back to court. They bring him back to court and say, this is your role, you're here, you're an advisor, you're a philosopher. And he runs away and they bring him back and he runs away. And this is constant. Until he runs into the woods and they lose him forever.
Yeah.
But again, Merlin hasn't died. Merlin is just wandering the woods somewhere. I would put my money on the Scottish borders, but other people say someplace else.
Much to the chagrin of my French teacher at high school. I learned that one.
Okay.
I learned a lot of my French from the Asterix books.
Oh, Asterix the Gaul.
And I love the fact that the magic man was Getafix.
Getafix, indeed. Yeah.
Not in other languages, but Getafix was a lovely English name for
but
him.
But if you look at the romantic poets in the later end of the 19th century, coming into the 20th century, of course, well, their problem was that you had all the dark satanic mills.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Industrial Revolution had taken off and we had got all the benefits. But the negatives had, we had dark satanic mills and we lost our link to nature. So they reinvent Arthur.
Yeah.
So he's no longer a warrior king. He's a chivalric knight in its chivalry. And Merlin is no longer this advisor, but he's this magical man who communes with nature.
Yeah.
And then they sort of morphed into inventing druids. Who pitch up at Stonehenge in the winter solstice and summer solstice.
Yeah.
There are people today who will say that they are Merlin. They genuinely believe they are the reincarnation of Merlin.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, if you go to Stonehenge and you go especially to North Wales, it's very strong there in the Welsh Valleys, where the Arthur legend to them isn't a legend. It's true.
It's true, yeah.
And it's part of their culture. And they will talk about the fact that Merlin, as they say, came up here to the borders, to Henoglath, to the Old North. But as far as they are concerned, I mean, we talked about this, are we Scottish, are we Welsh, are we British? Originally, we were all Welsh.
Yeah.
So you can call Merlin Welsh, you can call him Scottish. It's at that time, it was the same thing. But to them, the legend is, It's not so much that it is real, but it's part of them. You know, it's like the air they breathe in that part of the world.
I think that I started with the two ideas, ownership and origin.
Mm.
I think we've covered origin.
Yes.
As best we can.
Yes.
I mean, who knows in a sense. Maybe because the name Merlin, and let's call him Merlin, has cropped up so often when you've been informing me about this.
Mm.
Maybe it would be worth, you know, my money's on Welsh. You're talking about Scottish, whatever that means in a sense.
Yes.
Maybe it would be worth desiccating. That's coconut. By the way, the Monty Python and the Holy Grail, if I translate from the German, that is the Ritter mit der the Knights with the Coconuts.
That's right, because they made a thing of pretending to be on horses with coconuts.
So desiccated in my mind. But let's do another episode dedicated to Merlin, because this for me is a very fascinating part of this story.
Yes, because the Scottish roots of Merlin or Lailochan actually come from the writings of St. Kentigern, which is actually 5th or 6th century,
earlier,
500 years predating Geoffrey of Monmouth.
Yes.
So let's have a look at that and see if we can pick apart a few more legends there and see if we can find Lailochan, Merlin, the Henoglyph. It's just such a joy to pick apart these legends and see where we go with them.
Well, that would meet the curious and magical brief that we have, Mary.
And he is a very shadowy character. Trying to pin him down is like chasing a rainbow.
Yeah, excellent. Well, let's do that. And thanks a lot for that. That has enhanced my knowledge of this legend, which has followed me around the world when I travel.
I can't believe the Mount Etna one.
Yep.
I've never heard that. Yep. You see that Southern Europe.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
There we go.
But it's you mentioned the idea of the king in or under the mountain.
King under the mountain.
There's a volcanic eruption thing. Yeah. And this thing waiting
waiting to come back.
Come back.
Yes.
Albeit that part of the world is suffering with some very, very difficult climate conditions.
Yes, they've got some severe wildfires at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. And yet, speaking to someone who lives in Berlin, they had horrendously different weather yesterday compared to what's happening in the south. We often say, Mary, the real difference is north and south.
It is north and south. It is indeed.
Not the east-west.
But let's meet up another time and we'll chat some more about Merlin.
Let's do all things Merlin.
Yeah. Okay.
Mary, thank you very much.
Bye for now.
Bye for now. Bye.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. As well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.